Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. We have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America, or here in the local Monterey Bay at, well, 464-8295 Monterey Bay, out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but of course we ask you hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us a good friend, Don Scott. And Don has been coming across some fascinating new information in this search to understand why these new diseases are popping up. Chronic fatigue syndrome, which now infects between 800,000 and 1 million Americans. Maybe another 1 million or 2 million with chronic fibromyalgia. New diseases we never saw before. And then, of course, the AIDS epidemic, originating sometime probably in the mid or early 1970s, first be recognized in 1981, now having killed over 25 million people throughout the world, and here in the United States having killed well over 450,000 people. New diseases, and where do they come from? Don, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you just tell us, for our listeners who don't know you, why don't you just sort of give the background of how you got started in this whole story? Then I want to get into this this part nine of the of this special study, because there were some things in there that go into this whole idea of brucellosis. You'd, you know, obviously they were doing a lot of study on and work with brucellosis in this new study that has been so long suppressed.
Yes.
You pick the story up.
All right. I don't know how far back you wish me to go, but just let me tell your listeners, for those who haven't heard it before, that I am a retired high school teacher and university professor. At the age of 71, way back in 1995, I was called by a person who said, "Mr. Scott, you don't know me, but I'm ill and I need help." And it was a lady calling, and I said to her, "Well, if I can help you in whatever area you think I can, come on over and tell me about it on the weekend and bring any documentation with you." So this lady came along on the weekend, and she had quite a bit of documentation. And she said to me, "I have chronic fatigue syndrome." Well, at the time, I must confess, the expression didn't mean very much to me. I'd heard a few references to it, but nothing very deep, as it were, and I really didn't understand too much about it. And so I said to her, "Well, tell me about it. Tell me how I might help." And she said, "Well, it's an absolutely terrible disease." And she described the extreme fatigue, the headaches, the night sweats, the nausea, and so on. And then she went on to establish from written papers she had with her that her employer had used her very, very poorly, and that her union had essentially neglected her, and the insurance company that was supposed to give her benefits for short-term time off refused to pay her because they said that her illness was all in her head. Well, I went to work with her, and we together achieved an awful lot for her. But at the same time, I asked myself, what is there about this awful disease that causes employers to bully employees, that causes unions to neglect them, that causes insurance companies to deny them benefits and so on? So I began studying chronic fatigue syndrome. And I began by making up a 6-page questionnaire, and I sent it to close to 100 people that I was able to track down through various support groups who had the disease. And the questions were, when did you first become sick? What were your symptoms? What was the diagnosis? What was the treatment? And so on. And from that initial survey, I learned an awful lot about chronic fatigue syndrome, but I had no idea what I was going to learn over the years ahead.
All right. Well, now, of course, you've been researching this, and I had access to the work of many other people. And, of course, you finally realized that there were a lot of experiments that were done on our so-called war on cancer. And there were these various government reports. Most of them have simply disappeared. Going into the work that they were doing, trying to actually find out how they could create cancers, supposedly how that then they would be able to cure them. And they were finding out how they could utilize new diseases or create new diseases and all sorts of fascinating, fascinating things. The American people had no idea we were financing. And, of course, there was in the, what was that, part eight of this cancer project that Len Horowitz had found. Well, what did he actually find in that part eight? Now, didn't they actually pay these, wasn't this part of the research project to create a virus that would create immunodeficiency?
Well, that was part of it. And when you refer to part eight of this report, so maybe your listeners should be given a bit of background there. We now know from our research into chronic fatigue syndrome that it is related not only to AIDS, which it is, but it's also related to all the other neurosystemic degenerative diseases, which are characterized by something causing individual cells to break down and dump their organelles and everything else into the bloodstream and present as Huntington's, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and so on. And we also learned in our research, as you have indicated, that a great deal of work had been going on, first of all in deep secrecy, to develop some ordinary human diseases such as brucellosis. Well, actually, it's a disease of goats, sheep, cattle, pigs, but it does now and then leap into the human species. There was work being done from 1942 on between Canada, Britain, and the United States to take some of these diseases and make them more infective and increase their capacity to infect human beings. Now, this was to make a biological weapon. Instead of taking a piece of lead and molding it and firing it into somebody's brain, just get a little bit of this disease agent into that brain and have the brain dissolve, and you have effectively killed the person or certainly seriously disabled him. We then, now, when I say we, maybe I better explain that too. Shortly after I got into my study in 1995, to start with, of chronic fatigue syndrome, which led me into biological warfare research and so on, I did a couple of other things. One, I asked my son William to help me. He was a graduate from the University of Laurentian in Sudbury in history and political science, and he too has been spending the last several years researching these diseases. And we also did something else. We created what we call the Common Cause Medical Research Foundation. Now, Common Cause has a couple of meanings for us. One, we're talking about a disease agent that is common to chronic fatigue, AIDS, Huntington's, Parkinson's, Crohn's, colitis, and so on, and we have found that agent. And the other meaning of common cause is that it is a cause that is common now to the whole human race. This is a goal, the full understanding of this disease and the mastery of it or this disease agent. This is a common cause for all of humanity. So our Common Cause Medical Research Foundation has drawn people from all over the United States and Canada and indeed the rest of the world. And when I now talk about we, I'm talking about our Common Cause Medical Research Foundation. Now, getting back to the biological warfare aspects of this, there had been work going on before 1942 by different countries with different degrees of success in creating biological weapons. But in 1942, with the war on, Canada, Britain, and the United States agreed to pool their understanding, and they went very full time into the development of biological weapons. And one of them was the weapon that you referred to, the brucellosis bacteria. Now, there was something learned in the late 1940s of the, well, the last few years of the war. In 1946, it was reported. Dr. George Merck was the director of biological warfare research at that time, and it's very, very interesting that he parlayed his biological warfare research during the war years into a commanding position in the creation of so-called treatments for new and unusual diseases. We don't think that's coincidental. We think that he built his pharmaceutical expertise and profitability on what he had learned when he was developing biological weapons. Well, in 1946, George Merck reported to the Secretary of Defense that his researchers had learned how to do something very, very remarkable. He said that they had learned how to take the disease toxin from a bacteria. Now, a lot of your listeners don't know the difference between a bacteria, perhaps, and a virus. Well, a bacteria is a little one-celled animal. It eats, it processes nutrient, and it gets rid of the processed nutrient. It utilizes energy, and it reproduces. It's a little one-celled animal. But in the middle of that animal, there is a nucleus. And in that nucleus is either an RNA or a DNA, that is to say a blueprint for making more of itself. And some parts of this nucleus are extremely toxic to human beings. Well, George Merck reported that in 1946, his researchers had learned how to take this disease toxin, this nucleic particle, as it were, from the bacteria in crystalline form, and then discard the rest of the bacteria. Now, what significance does that have to your listeners out there? Well, it just means this. People can become ill from the crystalline or crystallized form of this disease toxin, and they can have all the symptoms of illness. But when they go to a doctor, there will be no signs of the bacteria. The doctor will do a test for brucellosis and ordinary blood and tissue tests, and there won't be any sign of it. But all of the indicators are that they've got brucellosis, but no bacteria. So it became a way of hiding the reality for the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes for Health to say to these people, well, you know, you've got all the symptoms of this disease, but you really don't have the disease. You're just imagining it. It's something in your head. The people didn't know what to think. They felt ill. They had all the symptoms of being ill, yet a blood test, negative, a tissue test, negative. And it has only been since the scientific advances have produced what they call the polymerase chain reaction testing that has permitted doctors to test patients who have symptoms but no sign of bacteria. And this polymerase chain reaction demonstrates the presence of particles of the nucleus of, among other bacteria, brucellosis. Well, they had then disease in pure crystalline form. And what did that mean for the biological warfare people? Well, it meant that they could take some of this bacterial crystalline form. They could mix it with an element which was the same density and all the rest of it, so that they could kind of spread it out. You know, if you have a teaspoon of Brucella disease agent, it could kill probably severely disable 100,000 people, but trying to get that teaspoon of it around to 100,000 people would be very difficult. So what they do, they take the teaspoonful of it and they mix it with an additive that spreads it out over several hundred pounds, and then they put these several hundred pounds into 30-pound burster bombs, and they fire these burster bombs over the enemy, and the disease communicates to the enemy. So they've got a new kind of weapon, one which is very hard to detect, one which is very disabling, and one which is very hard to cure.
Now, of course, it doesn't necessarily kill people. It just disables them.
Yes. Now, this was a policy of the United States, and it still is, that they wanted to have essentially disabling weapons. And their reason for that was quite simple. The thing is, if you kill a person, dig a hole and bury him. If you disable him, then you've got to use the time, the energy, the talents, and the money, and all the rest of the 5, 6, or 7 other people to treat him, to meet his needs for nursing care, and you take him out of the workplace and so on. So that the disabling weapon, although it doesn't kill, has a very severe effect on potential enemies.
Well, now, of course, when you got into this Part 9, and basically these are our reports. They're government reports. They're about 2.5-3 inches thick, and they have been totally suppressed. In fact, as Don has said, he's been contacted by the Senate trying to get copies of the government's publication, Part 8. They don't know where it is. These have all been shredded, destroyed. A few of them have been maintained. But not only that, he got into Part 9. Somebody found Part 9. Everything has been done to conceal from the American people the truth about this, these truly diabolical and evil people, the sort of people that would have the Tuskegee study recruit 400 black men with syphilis, not to be treated, but not to be treated. The same mentality that sees nothing wrong with a massive abortion and partial birth abortion, same mentality that sees nothing wrong with taking the property of the Japanese citizens away during the Second World War and sending them to concentration camps, to use them as a scapegoat to draw people's attention away from the fact that key people in government had manipulated the Japanese into attacking, knew the attack was coming, and did nothing to protect the lives of the men who were left at Pearl Harbor to die. There really are evil and wicked people out there. So, of course, fortunately, some of these reports did not get shredded. I think the first thing we ought to do is take every shredder away from the government so they can't already conceal all the wicked and evil things that have been done, so that someday at least some of these people will be called before the bar of justice. But now you've got Part 9, which is really even more fascinating. You'd sent me some material. You'd sent me the cover on that, and then you'd sent me index pages that were talking about Brucella. Now, was that the Brucella being discussed in Part 9? And for our listeners out there, that is the Undulant Fever we were just talking about, or the brucellosis. But was that in Part 9?
There are some allusions to brucellosis, but you see, Part 9 of this report, now, I had not made myself very clear about this, that in 1968, when Richard Nixon became President of the United States, he chose as his National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, who was a protege, disciple, or whatever, of the Rockefellers. And as a National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger took all of the research that had been going on, a lot of it in secret, and brought it really into a more mainstream activity. He, for example, took the MK SVLP, CIA military efforts to develop biological weapons, and he made it kind of a mainstream military effort by dropping the MK and changing the SVLP to SVCP. In other words, he and Nixon pretended while carrying on their research for biological weapons that they were really looking for a cure for cancer.
Now, supposedly we signed the Biological Warfare Treaty back in 1992.
Oh, yes.
Was that really more or less a cover so that people would not realize what they were up to?
Yes, it's typically a Nixon-Kissinger sneaky deal. Up until that time, the United States was one of the few, you might call in quotation marks, civilized countries that had not signed on to the Geneva Convention for the Control and Limitation of the Use of Biological Weapons. And suddenly Kissinger put the bright idea into Nixon's head, look, go on records and make a big speech and say that the United States is going to join the rest of the world in abolishing all efforts and offensive biological weapons and so on, and gain a great deal of respect and around the world. So Nixon did this, and everybody said, well, isn't that great? The United States has given up all this evil research. And then they went another step further. The Nixon Great War on Cancer, where they took the U.S. military laboratories in Fort Detrick, Maryland, or Frederick, Maryland, Fort Detrick in Frederick, and they converted those supposedly into laboratories to look for the causes and cures for cancer. But in the meantime, they were really still doing their biological warfare research. Now, when they went public, as it were, they also did that in a masterfully sneaky, insidious way. They produced these reports that you have alluded to, Progress Report Number 8 and Progress Report Number 9 and so on. And in these reports, they purportedly gave the account of how they were looking for what causes cancer and how to cure it. But when you read the reports with care and you study the background of the researchers and their other work, you find that buried in their so-called search for cancer causes and cures, there was a search for biological weapons, but it too was ratcheted up a considerable extent. Because in 1969, not only did Henry Kissinger go full-time on the biological warfare research, but they added another goal for their researchers. Besides creating just disabling diseases such as brucellosis would cause, they had already been working on, they already knew they could do it. They were developing a new pathogen, one which would not disable, but one which would kill. And that pathogen was the pathogen that causes AIDS.
Now, this is one they described that they, Dr. MacArthur was an Army scientist who had testified before the House Appropriations Committee on military appropriations, and I think it was for 1969.
Yeah.
And he basically said that we have the ability to create a new organism that will destroy the immune system, a virus that will destroy the immune system, and it'll cost about $10 million. We haven't, can do this in a relatively short period of time. You know, there's some people think maybe we shouldn't do that. And then he talked about creating an organism that will disable. So he was talking about two separate organisms, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, although the two separate organisms really were different one from the other, mainly in the element of concentration. But again, there's complications in discussing this, because one thing he said in his report that you allude to, which was June the 9th, 1969, an absolutely awful day in terms of history, because it was on that day, as you've indicated, that the United States military said to a group of 12 congressmen, look, gentlemen, give us $10 million and 5 or 10 years of time to do it, and we will give you the AIDS epidemic.
Well, he said a virus that will destroy the immune system, which
yes.
was the AIDS epidemic. And for our listener out there who's skeptical, we actually have copies of that segment of the report, and we'll be glad to send that to you. The whole idea that there really would be anything that diabolical is, well, it defies the average American's thought process. It couldn't be true. The tragedy is, it is true. And over 25 million people are already dead of the AIDS epidemic, the virus that destroys the immune system. If you'd like that segment, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and we'll be glad to send you that segment. We hope maybe you'll want to get the book by Len Horowitz, which I think is outstanding, Emerging Viruses, which goes into great detail on exactly the way that they went about doing that. So why don't you pick up the story from there? We know very well that they were planning to create the organism, and then in part 8 of this this planning document that you have, that Len had actually found, they actually one of the contracts was in there, wasn't it, by which they contracted to create this virus?
Yes. There's a great amount of information in their so-called Progress Report of 1971, which is Progress Report number 8. And if one gets that document, and we have it, one can go through it and see that there was a new microorganism being discussed that the average person, even today, doesn't know anything about. And that organism was what we call a mycoplasma. Now, what is a mycoplasma? Well, a mycoplasma is a particle of bacterial DNA without a cell wall. And this is exactly what people in the earlier years of secret research were studying. At that time, they called it PPLO, plural pneumonia-like organism. But they changed that name to mycoplasma as being a little bit more convenient to use, I suppose. But in Progress Report number 8, when you read it, it alludes to the fact that way back in 1962, a fellow by the name of Dr. Leonard Hayflick, he's still with us, he's still alive and kicking out there somewhere in the world. He wrote a book a couple of years ago about how to keep from growing old or the mysteries of aging. But anyway, Dr. Hayflick at Stanford University, which was one of the hotbeds of eugenics and one of the hotbeds of creating biological weapons to reduce the level of the world's population, Dr. Hayflick was given a contract by the National Institutes for Health, and he was to gather as many species of mycoplasma as he could. He was to preserve them. He was to do research on them, and he was to have them available for other government researchers who wanted to do work with the government, and this is using this disease agent.
All right. Now, this was a little-known organism. When I went to medical school, nobody ever heard of mycoplasma. At least I never did. Never even heard of the atypical pneumonia it produced until about, the late 70s or early 80s. So these are really new organisms as far as disease is concerned, and yet today 25% of influenza, the flu, is caused by these mycoplasms, and now suddenly they are throughout the entire society afflicting mankind. We're going to be back in just 3 minutes. You got 3 minutes. This is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you in the listening audience to help us do what we do 5 hours every day behind this microphone, trying to reach people across America to let them understand that you're not going to get the truth from Dan Rather or Barbara Walters or Tom Brokaw, because these people are paid large sums of money not to reveal the truth, but to conceal the truth from the American people. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to get the truth. We try to bring you as much as we can of the research that is available out there by people who have done a great deal of study on this, so you can begin to put the pieces of the puzzle together. But in essence, they've been creating new diseases. They've unleashed them on the American people. AIDS is an entirely new disease. Fibromyalgia, the chronic fatigue syndrome, these are new diseases. These are not old diseases. We never saw these during the early years of my medical practice. And now over a million people, or between 800,000 and a million, have chronic fatigue. A million have AIDS. Perhaps a couple of million have fibromyalgia. The government's even been so kind as to actually patent this specific, it would appear to be a genetically altered mycoplasm that is infecting so many people today with such disastrous results. But of course, they don't want you to know that the government has been working on this for many, many, many years. And of course, it's very difficult to admit that somehow this thing got into the general population, and that's why so many people are ill. So, and of course, we'll get more and more into that during the next hour. But anyway, we're hoping that many of you will decide you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, and just give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we think that this, hopefully we can begin getting more and more of the information out to the general public, so they will hopefully become involved and become concerned and help us then to demand congressional investigation so the truth can come out, because the one thing these people fear is exposure. It's like a vampire fears the first rays of dawn in the morning. Well, and very, very similar in other respects as well. We hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because the American people are under attack today. And these stories are so incredible, and yet the average person has no idea at all what's really going on behind the scenes. Again, the number, if you'd like to join with us and help us get the truth out, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening, Don Scott. We've got Mike calling in here. Mike, did you have a pertinent question or comment?
A question. I wondered if Mr. Scott could talk to us about the hepatitis B vaccine that was developed by Merck Laboratories and introduced to the gay population in New York City. I think that was 1979 or 1980.
It was about 1976, wasn't it, Don?
Well, there had been research going on in 76, but it was in 1979 that the United States government health agencies helped finance the vaccination programs in New York and in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And these were, from our studies and evidence, very, very clearly were programs that were designed to introduce the new disease agent into the population of the gay males, primarily of New York and the West Coast. Now, why would they target gays? Well, partly because they were such a bunch of, mentally aberrant researchers and military types. But they had a more insidious reason than that. A few years earlier, following the June 9, 1969 vote by Congress to, go ahead, develop the AIDS disease agent and get it out there and get it out into the third world countries to reduce the population of Africa and Brazil and certain other countries, they had done it by putting it into a vaccine. They had taken the smallpox vaccine, and they had put their new disease agent into it. Now, we've got all kinds of evidence to this effect.
Yeah, but now, when was that smallpox vaccine actually used, though?
That was started almost immediately after the June 9, 1969 meeting. They had called Dr. Henderson from CDC in Atlanta, Georgia, and they called him out as director. Now, I want to make clear that there's indications that Dr. Henderson had no idea that the smallpox that he and his 40 crews of Centers for Disease Control technicians and doctors were feeding to all the poor Africans and other third world countries. There's no indication that Dr. Henderson knew that, but he was in charge of it. He was called, primarily he was called at the end of 1968. Now what had happened then? Well, Richard Nixon had just become elected. And Henry Kissinger had just been appointed the National Security Advisor, so Henderson was called, okay, get up here to Washington. You're going to be working with the United Nations World Health Organization. You're going to go to Africa. You're going to go all over the world, and you're going to take this vaccine against smallpox. And Henderson, in his account of it, said he didn't want to do the job, but they pressured him. The boss of the CDC said, you have to go. So he started in the end of 1968, 69, 70. And now this also indicates something else to us. The military CIA people are doing a way, way more than ever meets the eye. And when they do admit to something, you have to accept the strong probability that they were already where they said they wanted to go. So in the 1969, 1970, off to Africa they went, and they vaccinated millions of black people against smallpox. Then in a whole period of 4 to 5 years' time, the people who had got the smallpox vaccine were beginning to present with AIDS. It's called a lentivirus. It's got a long hatching time, as it were.
Now, have we ever been able to actually demonstrate that it was in the smallpox vaccine? This has certainly been a theory. But how do we know it was actually in that vaccine?
Well, you know, it's like any crime where the criminal does everything he can to hide his fingerprints and hide his footprints and hide the evidence that he's been there. You just have to find what details you can at various points along the way and put them down so that you can see them sequentially. And in a certain number of instances, one does have to make certain assumptions based upon the lack of other evidence. And I know this, and I don't give these people the benefit of the doubt, because we do know from, for example, the hearings of June 9th, 1969, that several millions of dollars was voted that year not only to develop the synthetic microorganism, one for which no natural immunity could have been acquired, that's AIDS. Not only did they vote money for that, but they voted money for testing, millions of dollars for testing. Now, who were they going to test this stuff on? And we get some clues. You see, it's like any good detective will do. He will look for clues wherever he can find them. Now, we found a clue in 1975, because in 1975, Richard Helms called the Deputy Director of Plans, Sidney Gottlieb, and he said, Dr. Gottlieb, put your people to work, gather up all copies that you can find of these so-called special cancer projects, progress reports 8, 9, and so on, and shred them. That means there's something in there they don't want people to see. And what was there in there? Well, this is what
you'd mentioned that they put the order out for Dr. Gottlieb. Where is that? Is that written up someplace?
Oh, yes. We've got a number of documents, and we have them in some of the reports that we have prepared for the public. If they want to get in touch with us, we can provide them with information and sources, and they can go and check some of these out for themselves if they wish, or they can build upon what we share with them and then feed back to us further information on what we have. But in 1976, 77, 78, there was the hints of the epidemic of AIDS growing in Africa, and this is where this insidious scheme came in to take the disease agent and put it in the hepatitis B vaccine and then go to New York City, San Francisco, and Los Angeles and say to the gay population of those communities, look, fellas, We don't want you guys to get sick. So in order to avoid getting hepatitis, come and get a free vaccine we're giving out. Oh, there's a clue right away. They're giving out something free to a gay population. You've got to really suspect that something's going on. But several thousand people, gay people, did go and take this vaccine. And over the next couple of years, a significant percentage of those who took the vaccine, they did not, of course, develop hepatitis, but they developed a new disease, AIDS. And because that disease was in the gay population, politicians such as Ronald Reagan were able to say, not 1 cent of government money will be spent on AIDS research in my administration. And the people went along with this because they said, oh yes, right, this is the gay plague. This is a disease that comes from lifestyle that we repudiate. So therefore, don't spend my tax dollars on this. So the first 2 or 3 years of the AIDS epidemic, and of course you just have to read The Band Played On by Randy Schultz to get a full picture of that, the politicians were essentially able to deny proper research to what was going on until the disease was firmly locked into not just the gay population, of course, but the spreading out into the rest of the population of the United States.
Now, I think it's really so interesting. I actually studied the statistics on the epidemic in San Francisco, and they actually kept statistics on what happened to this group that was known as the cohort in San Francisco. And they found in 1978 about 4% of the people were HIV positive. I guess that was even before they took the virus, the hepatitis shot. But eventually, 77% to 78% of those came down with AIDS. Now, that is an awfully high percentage of people developing AIDS, because even today, as promiscuous as the gays are in San Francisco, only 25% of them are HIV infected. So, but here was 78% of the people who took this vaccine came down with the disease. And of course, those statistics initially made us think that this was just going to explode in the gay population, because nobody, even in their wildest nightmares, could imagine that the reason that these people were getting the disease was because of the hepatitis B immunization they'd taken. Because that was the furthest thing from my mind until I ran into Dr. Cantwell and Robert Strecker and eventually then into Len Horowitz, and suddenly realized that there was another explanation why 77 to 78% of those people went on to develop this terrible, terrible disease.
Yes, indeed. So that, for your caller, is our take on the evidence that we have accumulated and that others, like Len Horowitz, have developed for us, that the hepatitis vaccination program was a way of planting AIDS into the gay population, period. Now, let's go back.
Can we be sure it's a smallpox? Did they ever give hepatitis shots in Africa?
There's nothing that I recall offhand. There may have been some isolated instances, but hepatitis among the black populations of Africa does not emerge in my memory
as
a major problem.
Okay.
Now, is your listener still there?
Yeah, go ahead.
That helps a lot. I wanted to maybe mention also Lyndon LaRouche's activity, where he inflamed the homosexual community by bringing in the rumor that they were all going to be quarantined and therefore supposedly discriminated against.
Now, that was he did a magnificent job. He played his part very well, just as I believe Dr. Duesberg has played his part very well, and just confusing what this is all about.
Yes, well, when you mentioned Dr. Duesberg, he turns up in these special virus cancer programs, and although he is saying that HIV does not cause AIDS, he doesn't give the full story of what his role was in this whole thing. And I think that's a nice point to tie back into this progress report number 9 of Nixon's Great War, so-called, on cancer, because A few months ago, the president of our Common Cause Foundation in the United States, Miss Shirley Bentley, was able to locate through her network a copy of the Special Virus Cancer Program Progress Report Number 9. And she photocopied all 425 pages and sent it to me. And I was able to share certain parts of it with some of the other researchers in our foundation. And we began going through it with a great deal of care. And then we hit something in Progress Report Number 9 on page 39 is a very dramatic statement. The researchers for this Special Virus Cancer Program state in that report that we have learned for the first time that in order to activate the RNA-directed DNA polymerase, we first have to disable the endocrine system.
In other words, if you take out the endocrine system or get it so it's not functioning well, then you can begin getting this DNA particle that goes from RNA to DNA, which sounds very much like this lentivirus. You can get it to activate it to become active. So anything else you want to ask, Mike?
Well, one last thing. I keep thinking about the media campaign that was given to us in 80 and 81, where they held that AIDS was brought to the United States by one very promiscuous homosexual who had picked it up in Europe somehow, somewhere.
Gaetan de Gosse was his name.
Uh-huh. And apparently he was all over the country with as many partners as he could find, and that's how it began. And then all the graphics they put on TV and the news for us, the homosexual act giving us basically... homosexuality 101, would it be?
Well,
telling us that's how it all...
I think that was... But that was... I think a lot of that was just to confuse us. Okay?
Yeah, not just a lot of it. That was all part of the total media asset program. Now, when these people set out to commit these big crimes, they just don't say, well, let's go and commit this great big crime and see what happens. They have media assets. They have people who do their bidding as to what stories to tell the public. And we know this because, for example, we have in our files a copy of a CIA document which gives instructions to friendly media editors and writers and so on as to how to handle certain stories and get these out to the public, these misleading stories. Now, this story of Gaetan de Gosse, supposedly an airline steward for the TransCanada Airlines, as it was called at the time, or Air Canada, you're right that according to the official story, he was supposed to have had a sexual relationship somewhere in Europe with somebody who had had an earlier sexual relationship with a black woman in Africa who had been bit by a green monkey that was infected with the AIDS virus. Now, if you believe this, you will believe anything. You will believe Justice Rehnquist that George Bush Jr. was elected President of the United States. Because the thing is that they knew very well that the disease did not come out of Africa. It was taken into Africa. And it was taken into Africa so that it could be given to as many people as possible and reduce the population of that great continent. And in order to have a cover story, they had to have somebody involved that the public would not be sympathetic to. Who would be sympathetic to Gaetan de Gosse, who happened to be heterosexual when he's in Europe, but homosexual when he's in the United States, because of the attitude of people, especially at that time, towards the gay population. Another thing about Gaetan de Gosse, you have to note that he was not an American. And why is this important? It's important because it places him outside of the orbit of American congressional and senatorial hearings, because they can always call any citizen of the United States to Washington and get them before one of their investigating committees, but that by having it a foreigner, even though he's a Canadian, he's still a foreigner, and he's still outside of their reach. And when you read Randy Schild's book, The Band Played On, there's one place in there, I don't have the exact page number, but I could find it, where it says that the CDC was monitoring Gaetan Dugas' activities but could do nothing because, you know, free world. What were they talking about? There wasn't even a disease known at the time he started his so-called trips around the United States having 2,500 homosexual affairs. Does the CDC have somebody following every gay person, especially in those days before there was a disease recognized?
No, because they said he was very cooperative and he had a little black book and he would gave all that information to them.
Yeah,
their story.
Well, that was was supposed to have come out later. Who he had all these affairs with was supposed to come out later, but they were saying that even before he became ill and became a subject of particular attention, that they had been aware of his activities. But anyway, this is all the earmarks of a created myth in order to divert attention from the fact that the disease agent did not come from Africa into America. It came from America into Africa. And to divert attention from what was going on in Africa, they had to have a certain number of homosexual people in the United States infected, so that people like Ronald Reagan could say, there will be not 1 cent of government taxpayers' money spent on AIDS research during my administration. And I think it is so ironic that this disease agent, which we now know to be the factor, and it's the Mycoplasma fermentans incognita strain, is also the same pathogenic mycoplasma that's involved in Alzheimer's disease and, of course, former President Ronald Reagan has Alzheimer's. There's kind of an ironic element there that I puzzle on it from time to time.
Well, we perhaps can get into that a little later. Of course, Reagan was really a captive of his advisors. He really didn't know. They told him pretty much what to do because we knew some of them and what happened there. And maybe we could even talk about that because I was very close to that whole discussion in the 1987-1988 time period. So do you have anything else, Mike? We really want to get back to
one last thing and I'll get off. That worked. Ronald Reagan's statements worked very well. Whoever was pulling his strings did a bang-up job getting the left wing of the United States to militarize against the right.
Well, of course, this whole thing is manipulation, just exactly as today. I mean, what's the big issue about the attack on Afghanistan? Why, it's Johnny Walker. My goodness, we're going to talk about Johnny Walker and talk about it and talk about it and talk about it. And then those people down in Guantanamo in Cuba, they're the real enemy. These are the people we've brought over here. Boy, we've really got to treat them badly, punish them because of this terrible thing that they had done attacking the World Trade Center. Now, there wasn't one of those people who was involved in the attack on the World Trade Center. Many of them are Taliban. Many of them are Al-Qaeda. And we financed, our CIA financed the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And nobody ever talks about that. Nobody ever talks about the fact we were financing the Taliban in the year 2001. And we gave them large sums of money so they wouldn't keep planting the heroin. George Bush said in his September 20th speech last year, we are the largest financier, source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan. And that means, of course, for the Taliban. So we were financing the Taliban, and now we're trying to make these people, these poor, misled people, schooled in these radical Islamic schools. We're financed by our good friends, the Saudis, and by the CIA and by the Pakistani intelligence. These people are indoctrinated in hatred of the West, in part by our own CIA organizations. They are the enemy. Maybe we should take a second look at it. Let's get off that subject. Thanks so much for your call, Mike, and we want to get back to the original subject, okay? We've lost Mike, which is good. All right, Don, let's get on with this, because I think that's so important that people really begin then to see that here, because we found the mycoplasma, And this has been really genetically engineered. This is the one that they've actually taken the patent out, and we have copies of the government patent on this mycoplasma. How does this fit into the whole scheme of things?
Well, as you say, they have a patent on a pathogenic mycoplasma, and the pathogenic mycoplasma is called Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus strain, and they patented it because, just like any other weapon of war, it will be available to other criminal nations who want to use it, and there has to be some way of getting those criminal nations to pay royalties for its use, just as royalties are paid for the use of the Oerlikon gun developed in Sweden, royalties from any part of the world where that gun is used to kill off a bunch of people, Sweden gets a chunk of money under the international rules and regulations of patents. However, let's go back to that progress report number 9, where Richard Nixon's got his great war on cancer going. And on page 39, we find this dramatic statement that in order to activate RNA-directed DNA polymerase, now what does that mean? That means that in every cell of the human body, there's a DNA, a blueprint, well, almost every cell, but we won't get into that. There is a blueprint for making a new copy of that particular cell in keeping with the other cells in the body of the individual that has that particular DNA. The RNA is a particle of nucleic acid for the creation of, for example, viruses, bacteria, and so on. And in the case of the HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, so-called, this particle is able to attach to the membrane of particular cells in the human body. The membranes fuse, and the HIV is able to pass its RNA into the cell that it has attached to. Then it is able to make itself into a double-stranded RNA, which is spliced into the DNA of the individual that they've invaded, and they direct the body's own DNA to manufacture more of the RNA so that the body is always in a process of manufacturing more and more of the disease that is killing it.
And these are the virons that are then, I don't know, 10 billion of them are released every day. And these are really RNA virons, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And the thing is, the very important thing is to summarize in this respect. HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, plain and simply, does not cause AIDS. HIV is a viral particle, and it's actually a particle of the sheep's vesna virus. Our research is pretty solid on that. It is actually a virus, a viral particle, that is a...
Well, Dr. Stan back here, and Our guest this evening is Don Scott, and I got so interested in what he was saying, I wasn't paying any attention to the time. But now, when you say that HIV doesn't produce the disease, certainly there seems to be cofactors. There's mycoplasmin, because all the people have mycoplasmin, and all of them have HIV disease. So how do the two of them work together?
Well, the mycoplasma, it is now clear, is the agent that is used to disbalance the endocrine system.
Now, how does it disbalance the endocrine system? In other words, what the progress report 9 says is, if you want to get this whole chain reaction going, you've got to disbalance the endocrine system. So how do you disbalance the endocrine system, and where does it mention that the mycoplasm will do that? But first of all, how does the mycoplasm unbalance or disbalance the endocrine system?
It does it because of a particular characteristic certain species of the mycoplasma have, and that characteristic is this. Because it is only a particle of the DNA, the DNA, it doesn't have organelles of its own to uptake nutrient and process it and grow and develop. It has to take its growth requirements from cells that it invades. So the mycoplasma invades a cell, and in that cell, it has a need for growth product or nutrient, and it gets it by taking preformed sterols out of its host cell. So here's a host cell happily functioning away, doing its thing. Suddenly it's got an unexpected and unwanted visitor, the mycoplasma. And the mycoplasma generally is a pretty good visitor. It doesn't cause much trouble unless it's subjected to some kind of trauma. And then the mycoplasma begins to act up by uptaking preformed sterols from the host cell. Now, in progress report number 9, as you study the progress report, they make a reference to a very important part of their work at the time. It is a reference to a document written by Drs. Rotem, Fend, and Hayflick. Now, this guy Hayflick, he keeps turning up. And that document is called The Sterol Requirements of the Mycoplasma. And it is a critical document in understanding the AIDS epidemic, because the mycoplasma gets introduced into the victim. It accesses a cell, which it is genetically permitted to enter, because the cells are pretty particular about what they let in and out. And it only is people with a particular genetic makeup that allows these mycoplasmas into certain parts of their body. The activated mycoplasma begins taking the sterols out of its host, and then they kill the host by uptaking them too much.
Now you're talking about the cell, not the individual.
Yeah, the individual cell, the host cell is killed. And when that host cell is killed, it dumps all of its contents into the blood, including more particles of the mycoplasma, and they then access further cells, hence the progressive nature of the disease. But the tying it in with the endocrine system, hormones in the endocrine system, in the hypothalamus, the pituitary, the adrenal, the pancreas, and others, the hormones manufactured are manufactured from a sterol. You start off with a sterol, and the gland processes that sterol to make it into estrogen or testosterone or whatever. And if you have mycoplasma infection uptaking the sterol, you disbalance the endocrine system. And when you disbalance the endocrine system, says progress report number 9, you activate the RNA-directed DNA polymerase. In other words, HIV does not cause acquired immune deficiency. It takes advantage of it.
All right, fine. So basically, and then of course we begin to get this progressive immune suppression, which occurs, which is so much a part of the characteristic of this disease. And of course they lose their CD4 cells, their T4 helper cells, and they can no longer effectively fight infection.
Yes, and not only does HIV get turned loose to run madly around the house because the owner is disabled, but the pneumocystis carini pneumonia, the Kaposi sarcoma, and other disease agents that normally lie doing very little, if any, harm, are suddenly free to have a field day, and they then present in the victims. Now, there's another point that has to be made, and you can find this in the research of Dr. Xiaoqing Lo, who was the guy who patented on behalf of the U.S. government the pathogenic mycoplasma. It is a question of concentration. How much of the disease agent is in the victim? Now, in order to get a sufficient level of concentration to cause people to disbalance sufficiently their endocrine system and hence open the door for the opportunistic diseases, the concentration has to be pretty significant. And in order to get that, it requires a fluid transfer. Now that comes from a blood transfer. Infected blood will carry the AIDS from you to the other guy, or the other guy to you. Semen will do it. Mother's milk will do it. And vaccines will do it. And it was vaccines with the mycoplasma in it that was introduced into the smallpox vaccine and is given to black Africans who are now dying at the rate of 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 a day, because they have this sufficient level of concentration which gets perpetuated by ordinary heterosexual activity, among other things. Now, if they want to use it as a disabling agent, they don't communicate it at a level of concentration necessary or represented by fluid. They can communicate it by aerosol. In other words, they can put it into a room, and a person in that room can breathe this disease agent in, and it can go down through his lungs and into his bloodstream. But every step of the way, it is being fought by the immune system, because the immune system is not yet sufficiently disabled. However, with diseases like fibromyalgia, the disease agent is in the body, and the mycoplasma has taken up residence in certain cells that are genetically attuned to it, and then the individual will have a trauma of some kind. A rear-end automobile accident is a very common one. The person will be waiting to make a left turn, and the guy behind him will be daydreaming and drive into him. And the individual that is in the car that's hit, for example, nothing great is done to him in terms of harm. He just seems to be shaken up, and his car is not damaged, and he drives off after a bit of chat about it. And the next morning, he finds that he can hardly get out of bed. Something has happened to him. Now, we used to call it whiplash, but it's more than whiplash. The trauma has activated the quiescent mycoplasma in the different cells, and they have begun their destructive activity within those cells. Now, we've been looking at what the process is, and I won't go into the evidence on that. It's a little bit technical. It can, for example, access the brain. And this is why we surmise that a recent study of Alzheimer victims showed that 85% of Alzheimer's victims had had within 5 years before the onset of their symptoms of their disease, they had had some kind of trauma that rendered them, however briefly, unconscious. Now, it might have been, again, an accident, a fall. It might have been a bullet wound, such as President Reagan suffered when he was hit shortly after being elected. But that trauma initiates the disease activity again, and it does it in the brain. Now, what's going on in the brain? Well, as you, Dr. Stan, know very well, and some of your listeners are aware of as well, 85% of the brain is essentially water, H2O. 15% of the brain is other matter. And of that other matter, 3% is cholesterol. And cholesterol is a sterol, of course. And the mycoplasma is targeting that. So the mycoplasma in the brain gets triggered by a trauma, and it gets starts its process in just a few cells. It starts its process of taking the cholesterol out of the cell it's in, kills the cell. The cell ruptures, leaves a dead cell behind, and dumps its nucleic contents, and including glutamate and all the rest of it, into the blood, and the mycoplasma then accesses other cells. So there's a progressive activity in that individual's brain of the mycoplasma essentially eating the brain of its host cell by cell until there are great patches of places where there had been brain. There's no longer brain there. But in place of that brain are the useless protein fibrils and protein plaques that the mycoplasma has manufactured as it uptakes the preformed sterols. It's a really an interesting phenomenon.
Well, you mentioned the fact that Parkinson's disease, what percentage of people with Parkinson's would have had mycoplasma infection? Do we have any idea?
Oh, they all have. There's, as far as our research is concerned, anything we have ever seen where there has been proper autopsy studies of the brains of Alzheimer's victims does find the mycoplasma in however level of concentration.
Well, now, what about Parkinson's disease?
Well, yeah, now the Parkinson's disease is the same thing, only it focuses on a particular area of the brain.
The extrapyramidal system, right.
Yes, and it's unlike the Alzheimer's, because the Alzheimer's, of course, the cholesterol throughout the brain is a target. But with the other neurodegenerative diseases, let's take a very specific one, because it illustrates two or three points very well. Huntington's disease. Now, Huntington's disease, unlike the others, have to have a much greater level of genetic predisposition. In other words, both of the parents of a Huntington victim have to be positive for the presence of the disease susceptibility in the cell.
You're talking about the genetic predisposition to it.
The genetic predisposition, and that is centered in a part of the brain called the putamen. And if there's the genetic predisposition, then when the mycoplasma invades the putamen, we haven't seen much conclusive evidence on this, but we believe there's an element of trauma that gets it going too, it will begin to uptake the sterols in the putamen. And it puts the putamen, which is the area of the brain where most of the neurons and axons and all the other parts crisscross to direct movement, to coordinate speech and all the rest of it. And the mycoplasma initiates this uptaking of the preformed sterols, and as you know, there is a repeat of the CAG in the Huntington gene. The Huntington gene, it manufactures a protein for which no scientist has yet identified a purpose, but it's in there. The cell DNA will be happily manufacturing this protein, and then when it comes to a point where it's supposed to produce this trinucleotide called CAG, which is really glutamine, it doesn't just produce the one molecule of it and then go on to the next thing. It produces another and another and another and another until it will repeat 40, 50, 60, 70 times, and at that point, the cell gives up and dies.
Well, but now Huntington's been around for a long time before this mycoplasm was ever circulated.
Right on.
Right. So how do we explain the cases of Huntington that were there long before we ever had mycoplasm in our society?
Yes, what it is now is incidence. A greater number of people who are genetically predisposed by having two parents who are positive for the aberration in the putamen, a greater percentage of those are actually converting at a much earlier age into the actual disease. And it's just like all of the other related diseases. 20 years ago, how many people had ever heard of Crohn's colitis? It was essentially a disease that most people had no idea about, or multiple sclerosis. Again, 20, 30 years ago, if you met one person in your lifetime who had multiple sclerosis, except, of course, in your case, doctor, where you would see patients, but the average person would not encounter the numbers that are being encountered now. And if you look at the campaigns to raise money, for example, for the Diabetes Association, it will say that today another 80,000 people presented with the first symptoms of diabetes type 2 and the rest of it. And they talk about the dramatic increase in numbers. So it's not that these diseases are brand new. It is just that the pathogen, which is the background element, has been enhanced in terms of its infectivity and its level of activity. This is where the bioengineering came in, to take and make the disease agent pathogenic rather than rather benign.
Well, now, of course, we're seeing an awful lot of ALS, so-called Lou Gehrig's disease.
Oh, yes.
A few years ago, why, we hardly ever saw it.
Right.
And now, of course, we see it much more frequently. In fact, even the government admitted that it is seen much more commonly, or you're about twice as often in Gulf War veterans as in people who are not Gulf War veterans. And of course now, but they were talking about 40 or 60 people. So now they're going to, of course, go ahead and take care of Gulf War veterans with Lou Gehrig's disease, with ALS, saying it's service-connected. But that, I think, is simply another one of these issues of focusing our attention on the wrong issue. In other words, boy, now we're really going to be magnanimous. We're going to take care of these 40 to 60 people. But, of course, they're avoiding the real issue, and that is, what other devastating facts do we have from the etiological agent? Because apparently, at least according to Garth Nicholson, all of the ALS patients that came back from the Gulf are mycoplasm positive.
Absolutely. And the same thing is happening. You see, the long nerves that transmit messages from the brain down to the toes to start with, for example, they have to be constantly replenished with sterols, especially cholesterol, to maintain themselves and their viability. And our studies indicate that these longer nerves that are involved with ALS, because the nerves lose their capacity to transmit messages to the toes, and hence the toe muscles can't move the toe because it gets no message to move it, the nerves draw their supply of replenishing sterols from the gray matter of the lower spine. And if that gray matter, which normally produces a sufficient level of the replenishing sterols is invaded by the mycoplasma, and the mycoplasma is uptaking sterols too, then there is not the sufficient level of sterols going to these cells to replenish the ones that are getting used up in the process of the cell's normal activities. And the cell begins to lose its capacity to communicate the message to the muscle of the toe, or and then of the leg, and then of the lower bowels and all the rest of it. The whole system, as you know, just backs right up to the brain until the only part living in the human being, actually in terms of being able to be moved and functioning, is the brain itself. So there's a very real link between the mycoplasma and ALS, and it's based upon the reality that the mycoplasma is uptaking preformed sterols and destroying the capacity of the nerves to carry the messages.
Well, now, Chris, Dr. Garth Nicholson has written about this, and a lot of work on that. Has anybody else written about this relationship between the mycoplasma and these progressive degenerative neurological diseases? Is there other mentioned elsewhere in the medical literature?
Well, there are references, and we have stacks of material here. However, references to the mycoplasma are extremely hard to come upon. Now, we think this is intentional because, you see, the U.S. Institutes of Health, NIH and CDC, cooperated all the way along with the Department of Defense in creating these pathogenic disease agents. And they do not want the world to know the role of the mycoplasma. And in fact, they get almost panic-stricken if anybody even suggests that there's a role. It reminds me of a wonderful researcher, Dr. Harold Clark, formerly of Georgetown University and George Washington University, professor emeritus, a real fine gentleman and a real fine researcher. He got in touch with me a few years ago, and he's now a member of our foundation, by the way. And he told me in a personal letter, and I'm sure he doesn't mind me sharing this with you, that when he and his fellow researchers discovered the role of the mycoplasma in rheumatoid arthritis, they published a paper on it, which they thought would draw accolades and response and further research. And he says, we were surprised because our research funding from NIH and CDC dried up. Well, why, when you come upon a factor in a disease that promises to ease the suffering of victims, does the NIH cut off funding? Well, they cut off funding because any mention of mycoplasma threatens them. You see, when the truth is finally known, and I have to have faith it will be recognized that the greatest crime in the history of humanity was the development of the pathogenic mycoplasma, which has unleashed not just AIDS and chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, but has enhanced the ability of the disease agent to cause even more of these other collateral damage diseases. And someday, somebody is going to be aware that the National Institutes of Health are actually the National Institutes of Death, and that they are culpable for probably the greatest crime in the history of mankind, the development of the mycoplasma communicated by fluid transmission to millions of black people especially. Because you see, part of the United States research problem was this. It is a reality, tragic but true, that you can kill off 6,000 people a day in Africa and the third world, providing they are black people. Because really, who gives a darn? But if they were killing off 6,000 people a day in the United States, Canada, Britain, Germany, and France, there would be such a political uproar. There would be a revolution, and something would have to be done about it. So they can't kill off the people of our so-called Western civilized areas. They can only disable them, and particularly disable the women. Because chronic fatigue, we know, targets women more than it targets men. And our research indicates why. Because our research demonstrates that these diseases have to present in terms of a number of factors. One is barometric pressure, strange as it may seem. Another is temperature. Another is pH. Another is level of concentration. And that's where women come in. A woman, as you know, doctor, has 20 to 25% less blood, pound for pound, than a male. And that woman's blood has 20 to 25% less hemoglobin than her male counterpart. Therefore, if you take two people, one male, one female, both 200 pounds in weight, and you introduce a level of concentration, in the male, it will not be at the point where disease will present. But because of her lowered level of blood volume and her lower level of hemoglobin within the blood, the critical concentration will be reached in the woman 6 or 7 times faster than in the men. And that's why people were able to say in the early days of chronic fatigue that it's a disease of stressed out women who couldn't cope with the challenge of the day.
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things is the extent that the CDC and the NIH did not to try to find out the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome. And that wonderful book you've mentioned many times, Osler's Web by Hillary Johnson, points out that Congress would keep appropriating money to do research on chronic fatigue, and the NIH and the CDC would transfer to other areas, but refuse to finance people, for the most part, were trying to research and figure out what indeed was the cause of this terrible disease. So it didn't matter, you know, what Congress wanted, didn't matter what the people wanted. There was an agenda on the part of people within the health establishment or the military, medical establishment, call it what you will. But these people were really not dedicated to the public health, but rather dedicated to some other macabre idea. Now, this is not the average doctor. Most doctors are wonderful people, and most researchers are, but it seems that the people who gravitate into positions of power are usually the most evil. Have you run into that?
Oh, certainly, and there's a very good example. The director of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Brian Mahi, he received somewhere around $16 or so million voted by Congress over the period of 2 or 3 years, and Congress said, look, Dr. Mahi, here are these millions of dollars. Go ahead now, research chronic fatigue, find out what causes it, find out how we can cure it. And Dr. Mahi said, well, thank you very much, gentlemen, and he took the money into the CDC for which he was, of which he was in charge. And after a few years of nothing coming out, a Dr. William Reeves, who was also with the CDC, called a press conference. And he, I have copied the press conference here, and he said, my name is William Reeves, and I'm a researcher, doctor, and so on, with the Centers for Disease Control. And under the protection of the Whistleblowers Act, I want to state that the director of the CDC has not been spending the money voted by Congress to study chronic fatigue syndrome. He has been using the money in other ways. Well, because of the Dr. Reeves' high position, he couldn't be easily dismissed, and utilizing the Whistleblowers Act, Dr. Mahi couldn't fire him.
So we're going to have to interrupt you there. We'll be back in just 3 minutes, Don.
Okay.
Dan and this is rather a complicated subject we're talking about tonight, but believe me, there's a lot of fascinating information here, and this is what you need as a background. You almost need to get a copy of the tapes of these programs so you can understand what we're really talking about and listen to them two or three times. I can understand, Don, because I studied medicine for many years and have been studying this subject for many years. And he is, of course, has a put together an institution with all sorts of very top-notch medical people who are working with him and recognize that this is one of the greatest cover-ups of all time. A program of planned genocide that has already killed 25 million people, another 40 million people infected with HIV disease, how much morbidity we've had, people suffering, and you know, for these other diseases that they've created, and now into the general population. You want a documentation on that? They actually released this originally in a place called Huntsville, Texas. We have interviews with the people who researched that. The government denied and denied and denied that the prison was being used for experimentation. And then, of course, a couple of women who lived in Huntsville and who had friends who had developed progressive degenerative disease found the contracts. And that, of course, put the end to the denials. Then they had to silence these women. They had to silence anybody who talked about it, which is why they had to force Dr. Garth Nicholson out of his tenured position at MBA clinic. Cancer clinic in Texas. Well, this information needs to get out. This is what we do 5 hours a day. We hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family because that's how we're able to do what we do. And again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to becoming part of our team. And, of course, when you join the Radio Liberty family, you get our four best tapes of the month. You get our monthly newsletter. But more than that, you're helping us do what we do. And that is bring the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And then, of course, we hope you'll go to our website and you'll tell others about the website at RadioLiberty.com, where ordinarily you can get our programs archived there. And we, of course, have our new monthly newsletter and other items, which we'll be putting up more and more of in the weeks and months that lie ahead. So again, our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America really is under attack today. The trouble is most people think it's a war on terrorism. The war is really on the American people and humanity as a whole. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Don Scott. We're going to get his telephone number out. If you'd like to give us a call, our number here, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Don, you want to get your address out there and your website?
Yes, if I could mention a couple things. But could I finish off with Dr. Mahi?
You go right ahead with Dr. Mahi.
When Dr. Reeves blew the whistle on Mahi, the government, General Accounting Office, had no way around it. They had to appoint an audit team, such as had to be appointed for Enron. And the audit team went into the Centers for Disease Control, and they said, okay, now, you got these millions of dollars to study chronic fatigue syndrome. Let's see the contracts that you signed to study the disease. They found that $4 million had been spent on what might reasonably be deemed to be research. Another few million dollars was very questionable. But they couldn't say that it was totally unethical. But the amazing thing was that in the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, under the directorship of Dr. Brian Mahi, $4 million had totally disappeared, and they had no way they could trace it. Well, you'd think, you know, that if a guy's in charge of an organization that loses $4 million, that he would lose his job. No, not at all. Dr. Brian Mahi is still working for DCDC. He's in another office, and they've got an acting director now taking his place, but he's still getting his paycheck. Imagine that. And why is that so? Well, we have found Dr. Mahi involved in the whole chain of command and research for the development of the AIDS virus and the chronic fatigue pathogen.
Well, now, that's a pretty strong statement that he was involved in creating the AIDS virus.
Yes.
Can you actually prove that?
Yes. What I'm saying is he was doing research at one point in his career which ties into the whole pattern of research which we have been tracing. We have been taking these individual people, digging out their research papers, and finding how they tie into the all the activities of the mycoplasma research and the testing and so on of that. And we know that Dr. Mahi, a number of his papers fit very solidly into that pattern of evidence that we have, and we're quite prepared to share it. In fact, going back now to your suggestion that we tell how your listeners can get in touch with us, let me mention a couple of things, if you don't mind. From July the 14th to July the 28th, in other words, 14 very solid days, up here in the city of Sudbury, Canada, we are having a 14-day study session which will be focused on the major papers by Dr. Hayflick and Dr. Rotem and Dr. Hubiner and Dr. Gallo and Dr. Mahi, and we will follow these papers day by day for 14 days, demonstrating very clearly that the HIV does not cause AIDS, that AIDS is caused by the damage and disbalance to the endocrine system, and that it is the mycoplasma that does it. And we have all of these documents now. They are all government documents. So don't anybody suggest that we've made something up. We have copies of these, and people have been very helpful with us in getting them. Now, it costs $100 to get the supply of documentation, and it costs $200 to register for 14 days. But if you want to study these diseases and get the fundamental papers in a sequence that you can understand them, you can come to Sudbury, July 14th to the 28th, and you can stay at a beautiful facility we have here, room and meals, very, very economically. And you will go away well aware of the fact of where these diseases came from. That's point one, Dr. Stan. The other point is that we publish a journal of degenerative diseases, and we are focused on the medical aspects of all of this. But we have also started publishing a magazine for lay people. It's called ABLE, A-B-L-E. Who is able to stand, the Bible asks. And who is able to judge? Well, we're publishing a magazine called ABLE.
Now, you can't put the price out, but they can call me. And this is a non-commercial station. If anybody wants to know the price, they can call us, and we'll tell them what it is.
Okay.
You tell them where they're supposed to write.
Okay, they write to Box 37021.
37021. Anybody wants to know the price, you can call us and we'll tell you how much to send.
And it's Ottawa, Canada. And the postal code is K as in King, 1, V as in Victor, 0, W, 0.
All right, fine. And please give me the full address again.
ABLE.
Right.
Box 37021.
Ottawa, Canada.
Canada, K1V0W0. And we will be able to provide you with a subscription to ABLE, and Dr. Stan will be able to give you the price. It's quite economical. We wanted to make it that way so that anybody who has the heart and the soul that is moved by the tragedy of these diseases can have access to solid evidence. We spend day after day, hour after hour, researching. We want to share that with folks, And I want to thank Dr. Stan for this opportunity, too. You're doing a great job, Dr. Stan, and, you know, the world needs to appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I think that the interesting thing that you point out is the difference between the AIDS and chronic fatigue is all the people with AIDS have HIV, but all of them have mycoplasma. This is what's been missed all along. In fact, Luc Montagnier made that point. Dr. Loeb made that point. And so we focus on HIV. They all have HIV, and it plays a part, but you have to have the mycoplasma there, I think, before you get it. Would that be a fair thing to say? Whereas if you have chronic fatigue, you don't have HIV?
Yes, that's a fair thing to say, and it also explains the anomaly people find of people who have been ill, who have HIV. That's the one category, but then they found all kinds of people who have HIV who are not ill. And why are they not ill? Because their endocrine system is still functioning 100%. They don't have the mycoplasma.
All right. Now, what about treatment for these diseases? Is there any effective treatment?
Yes. When it comes to AIDS, we think that the treatment is totally misdirected. What they are trying to do is treat the effects of, say, a flooded river by going downstream where the great wall of water has washed away houses, instead of going upstream where they could close a small sluice gate and stop the thing from getting started in a variety of different places. In other words, they are directing their research at the effects of the pathogen, which has been turned loose because the endocrine system has been disbalanced. They're not going back and saying, well, wait a minute, let's get the endocrine system back into balance. Well, how do you do that? Well, the one thing is you have to address it with a antibiotic, which will limit the development of the mycoplasma. Now, the mycoplasma, as a particle of bacterial DNA, is extremely hard to destroy. In fact, it's almost impossible to destroy. But it can be contained. And the disease antibiotics such as minocycline, doxycycline, tetracycline, and so on, these can be treated as bacteriostatic agents. They won't kill a mycoplasma, but they will limit its capacity to uptake sterols and do further damage. So it seems only logical, and Dr. Garth Nichols has been doing great work on this, to limit the disease agent that disbalances the endocrine system with an antibiotic. Then there has to be an attempt to reestablish endocrine balance. The hypothalamus, the pituitary, the adrenal, all of these have to be put back into place. And that requires other kinds of treatment, which we have information, and if people write to us, we will provide it to them. We have a two-page sheet paper which lists some of the ways that the endocrine system can get back into balance.
All right, let's go to Susan, who's calling here from Santa Cruz. Hi, Susan, your question or comment?
Hi there. Both, I think. I've had a couple of friends, several friends, one with rheumatoid arthritis, two with chronic fatigue, and they have been tested for mycoplasma, but for them, it turned up nothing. And in one case, a chronic fatigue patient was treated with antibiotics just in case, and it didn't seem to have any effect. Now, I don't know if that was long-term enough. So I was wondering, how easy is it to miss the mycoplasma? Is this commonly tested? Do people know how to test for it well? Are there false positives and so on?
All right. Question then, Don, would be how these people were tested for mycoplasm, but can you miss the mycoplasm with a routine test?
Yes, very much so. And we go right back to the antecedents. You see, as I mentioned, the mycoplasma is a particle of a bacterial DNA. Well, that means that somewhere back along the line, there was a bacteria with a DNA. And what bacteria was that? Well, our evidence is that the bacteria that they primarily used was brucellosis. And when you take a look at the disease that brucellosis produces in humans, it's the chronic brucellosis, it is 100% corresponding to chronic fatigue syndrome. Since the disease agent sequesters itself inside cells and will frequently lie there for long periods of time doing little or no damage, it is possible that a person who initially presents with a disease, if they are tested for the presence of the brucella, will not find it unless you get a very sophisticated test. And that very sophisticated test is the polymerase chain reaction.
The so-called PCR test.
Yes, and they cost $500 or so to get. And, you know, this is out of the range. But the sheets, the two sheets of paper that we have for people who have some of these diseases, what we have tried to do is say to people, okay, look, if you had a PCR, there's a much better chance that if the mycoplasma is there, it will be found. However, if you use ordinary blood and tissue tests, you're only going to find 40 or 50% of people who are ill with these symptoms who actually show in blood and tissue that they have the disease agent. That doesn't mean they don't have it, it's just it doesn't show. And this was the truth about chronic brucellosis. Extremely difficult to find it because of its capacity to sequester itself mm-hmm. until the defenses of the body are down and it can have its way again. So we send out this sheet to people who write to us and ask us. We don't make any charge for it, of course, because what we want them to be able to do is do this. It's to use an analogy. You may not be able to find somebody who actually saw the criminal going from place A to place B. However, you can find certain pieces of evidence that show that he was indeed going from place A to place B. And that's the kind of evidence that we propose to people that they can get very economically, which if they prove positive in these very economic and readily available tests, are like the footprints in the snow. You didn't see the criminal, but you saw his footprints.
Joe, you can, all I have to do is write you then at Abel or at your name, Don Scott,
yes,
Post Office Box 37021, Ottawa, Canada, is that K1VO?
Yeah, K1V0W0.
So why don't you get that from Don? In fact, if you get it, why get me a copy of it? I'd like to have it myself for our patients.
I'll send you one, doctor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fine.
There's just one last comment. One person said the one thing that made him feel better from chronic fatigue was taking plant sterols, which makes me think maybe he's replacing the sterols that the mycoplasma is.
Yes, and we have seen this kind of treatment. We've seen it work. But the trouble with it is, when you're taking the sterols, you're feeding the mycoplasma without it having to take your cells apart.
Right.
It's as if you look out your back window in a country area and you see two or three wolves roaming around, and you say, well, God, those wolves are apt to eat the kids, so we'll put some meat out for them, and they'll eat the meat and they won't bother the kids. Well, then the next thing you know, there's 10 wolves, and you got to put a lot more meat out, and then there's 20, and you got to put a lot more, and then they eat the kids and you.
Right.
Now, Don, what about the smoking? Have you ever heard that smoking will help this, the nicotine?
No, I've never heard that it would help.
All right, fine. Well, I just wondered if you had ever heard anything else, Susan?
No, let's just go. Good night.
Good night, and thank you. And really, I think everybody out there knows somebody who has one of these diseases that are becoming increasingly prevalent today. Is Parkinson's disease on the increase, Don, do you know?
Oh, our evidence is that it is. But, you know, I wrote to our government, Department of Health, and I said, would you give me figures on these diseases? And I listed Parkinson's and Huntington's and multiple sclerosis. And I had a very, very, very hard time getting any reply at all. But finally, I got a report from the Minister of Health who said that he had given a task to one of his staffers, and the staffer had searched literature trying to find out how many people had these diseases today and how many had it 5 years ago. And it's actually very hilarious to see what he sent me. They had allusions to magazines that they'd found bits and pieces in. They had no scientific studies or no real statistical indications of how many people had these diseases. And, of course, that makes it very convenient for them because they can say, well, we don't know that Parkinson's is on the increase. However, go back again to anybody who's remembered 25 years ago and ask them if they recall at that point anybody with Parkinson's. Then ask them, okay, look at today. Pope John Paul, Michael Fox, Billy Graham, Yasser Arafat, all kinds of people come to mind who have Parkinson's.
Yes, and the Muhammad Ali.
Oh, Muhammad Ali, right on. That's another one that we are aware of, yeah. So, again, there's this whole problem that officialdom, which should be working to maintain the health of our nation and your nation, have something they want to keep hidden.
Well, we're seeing more, certainly Alzheimer's disease now. Of course, they justify it by saying, well, that's because people are living longer. But is that really the case? Or, you know, is this simply part of the cover-up of all of these new diseases that are coming down the line? And they don't want anybody asking, where did AIDS really come from? Where did chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia come from? They deny they even exist. And yet, of course, you tell that to somebody who has the disease.
Yes, and you take that comment you made that they say, well, people are living longer. It doesn't hold up because what we are seeing in the statistics is that instead of the person with Alzheimer's being on average 75 and over, we are finding so many who are in the area of age 65 and age 40. Take a look at Michael Fox, how young he is, and he with Parkinson's. And this takes us back, of course, to our research again in Akureyri, Iceland, when one of the first instances of an epidemic of chronic fatigue broke out. There were 1,700 young people affected by it. And of these 1,700, five of the young people under age of 17 developed Parkinson's disease and died. Now, what does this mean? This means that the same pathogenic agent that causes chronic fatigue also causes Parkinson's. And we see this also in our survey, for example, that we sent out about chronic fatigue. Does anybody else in your family have any of the following diseases? And we listed them. There were so many ladies who said, I have chronic fatigue, but my husband has Parkinson's, or my husband has multiple sclerosis, or something along that line. They didn't know that they both had the same disease agent at work. It was just showing differently, because one's genetic predisposition was one way, and the other's was another way.
And I think that's really what's so frightening. And, you know, there is so much evidence that certainly ALS, this horrible, horrible disease, you know, from which the only escape today is death, progressive neurological abnormality. And, of course, you keep getting weaker and weaker and weaker. Usually runs a course of 5 years, hits people ordinarily 50, 45, 50 years of age. And then they just go on. They get to the point they have respiratory collapse and they die. You know, and yet we're seeing so much more of this today. According to Dr. Nicholson, 100% of those that came from the Gulf have the mycoplasma. About 80 to 85% of the general population would have it, whereas you'd only find this mycoplasma in 5% of the overall general population. So it is these people with these horrible, horrible, horrible diseases, and of course they have this. And, of course, everything is being done to cover this up. In fact, every pressure was put on Dr. Nicholson, actually threats against him and his family to force him out of MB Anderson Clinic in Texas because he dared to investigate the outbreak at Huntsville, Texas, where the government released this in the general population. And, of course, from there, it spread far and wide. I'm sure you're well aware of that Huntsville, Texas experiment.
Yes, indeed. The ladies who were involved in making that marvelous study sent me a copy of their study, and it's certainly been very, very helpful. And we also know that there have been other kinds of tests conducted, and I've used this example before, but some of your listeners may not have heard it. Back in the 1950s, when they were really getting rolling in all of this, and they realized that they could have certain kinds of vectors carry the disease agent besides fluid like blood and semen and so on, they wanted to find out if insects could carry it. So the United States government asked the government of Canada, would you help us in this? And the government of Canada said, yes, what do you want us to do? And they said, would you breed 100 million mosquitoes a month? And they said, yes, we would. And they established the Dominion Parasite Laboratory in Belleville, Ontario, Canada. And they began breeding 100 million mosquitoes a month. And then they shipped these 100 million mosquitoes every month to Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, Canada, where Dr. G.B. Reed, head of biology, contaminated the mosquitoes with various experimental disease agents that the war people had developed.
Now, is that actually, you actually have a...
We have it solid.
Yep. I would think that the people, if the people of Canada and the people of the United States knew that, they would be up in arms to we've been experimented on, and they've unleashed these terrible diseases.
If only they would be up in arms. But there's such a tragic disposition to say, well, what can we do about it? But they did breed the mosquitoes in Belleville, and they did contaminate them in Queen's University. And when I first revealed this to the public, the dean of Queen's University said, if Mr. Scott says that again, we will sue him. So I said it again. I issued a press release. I sent it all over the Kingston area, as well as internationally, but our local Canadian broadcasting company wouldn't carry it at all for reasons that only they know best. But lo and behold, instead of suing me for saying it again, the dean refused to answer my letters anymore. And I have not been sued, and I visit Kingston, and I say it every opportunity. But you see, they don't want anybody in a court of law, under proper rules of procedure, and under sworn testimony, telling the truth.
Well, this is we could go on and on, but 2 hours have flown by, Don. Thank you so much for being with us, and hope we can call on you again. I hope our listeners out there understand what we're up against. We're up against organized evil on a degree that's hard for the finite mind to comprehend. The only explanation is evil. And when are the American people going to stand up and say, and the Canadian people as well, we're going to get to the bottom of it, we're going to demand that, or are we simply going to allow them to continue until they accomplish their goal, and that is the elimination of significant parts of the populations, not only of our countries, but the world. Don, God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. I appreciate your work.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Well, this is we touched a lot of things this evening. I hope you're intrigued. I hope you want to get the 4 tape sets and help us get the truth out across America. Until tomorrow at the same time, pray for America, pray for revival, and please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.